On the show today, President Joe Biden reaffirms support for Israel.
We stand with Israel. We will make sure Israel has what it needs to take care of its citizens, defend itself, and respond to this attack.
Plus, the U.S. Secretary of Defense is headed to Brussels for the meeting of the Ukraine Defense Contact Group with news of a U.S. aid package for Kyiv.
So they are planning to show Ukraine that the United States and all of Ukraine's Western allies are still very much committed to supporting Ukraine for as long as it takes.
And later Tuesday was Election Day in Liberia, and a closer look at China's Belt and Road Initiative in Africa. Today is Wednesday, October 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. VOA is on the ground in Gaza and in Israel. That story in a few minutes. We begin, though, at the White House. President Biden said on Tuesday that he will ask Congress to take urgent action to help defuse Middle East tensions. This after Hamas attacked Israel over the weekend, killing more than 1,000 people, including at least 14 Americans. Analysts say the possibility that Americans are among those being held hostage by the militant Palestinian group complicates the situation. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
President Joe Biden minced no words in describing the shock and horror of Hamas' surprise weekend attack on Israel.
This was an act of sheer evil. More than 1,000 civilians slaughtered, not just killed, slaughtered in Israel. Among them, at least 14 American citizens killed. Parents butchered using their bodies to try to protect their children. Stomach-turning reports of babies being killed. Entire families slain.
And he clarified Washington's stance on Israel's counteroffensive.
We stand with Israel. And we will make sure Israel has what it needs to take care of its citizens, defend itself, and respond to this attack. There's no justification for terrorism. There's no excuse.
To that end, he said the U.S. has sent a strike carrier group to the region, and he says he'll ask Congress, once a new House Speaker is elected, to take urgent action to fund the national security requirements of our critical partners. Analysts say the carnage has touched a raw nerve at the White House, which illuminated itself in Israel's color over the tragedy. Daniel Byman is a senior fellow with the Transnational Threats Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
There may be Americans captured by a terrorist group, and that's got to be a priority of any American president. And the second issue is coming to terms with the deaths of Americans in a terrorist attack in Israel. Add to that all the complexities of a very difficult regional situation. And it involves not only Israel and Hamas, but the possibility of Hezbollah and Iranian involvement. So President Biden is trying to wrestle with all these.
VOA asked the White House whether Biden asked Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to exercise restraint in his military response. John Kirby is Director of Strategic Communications for the National Security Council.
Nobody wants to see innocent life taken. As I said, there's been too much of it. One of the great things about our relationship with Israel is that we're two vibrant democracies, and we mutually believe in things like the respect for innocent life and the rule of law. We're always stronger together, our two countries, when we show that to the world, that we do respect innocent life and that we do respect the not only the rule of law, but the law of war.
U.S. adversaries were quick to point blame. Russia's President Vladimir Putin said, "Unfortunately, we can see a sharp deterioration of the situation in the Middle East. I think that many will agree with me that this is a clear example of the failure of the policy of the United States in the Middle East, which tried to monopolize the resolution of the conflict, but, unfortunately, was not concerned with finding compromises acceptable to both sides." Kirby said conflict in Israel won't take Washington's eye off other threats, wherever they are.
Any nation who might think that somehow the United States is going to get distracted should think again. We are a large enough, big enough, powerful enough country, economically viable enough. In fact, the economy is incredibly strong right now, that we can look after our national security interests and those of our allies and partners anywhere around the world.
Nor, Biden said, will he walk away from Israel. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
An update from the Pentagon coming shortly. Now, though, as Israel continues its retaliation against Hamas in the Gaza Strip, the surrounding areas have been evacuated, and the families of at least 150 hostages inside Gaza are growing increasingly terrified. VOA's Heather Murdoch is there, and she reports that Israelis are growing increasingly angry at their own government's reaction to what's becoming a devastating war for both sides.
Israelis living in the areas surrounding the Gaza Strip have been evacuated, and rockets continue to shoot out of the enclave. The more than 2 million Palestinian people inside are trapped, as it is pummeled by heavy weaponry day and night. Among the civilians in Gaza are as many as 150 Israeli hostages. Family members are terrified that their loved ones will not be rescued. This is Solars Adolfo, whose niece went missing the day of the initial attacks. He believes she was taken hostage.
I don't know how it is going to end, but the end will not be a happy end for nobody. It's not a happy end for nobody.
Humanitarian groups inside Gaza say the crisis is deepening for civilians, already cut off from the world, and now cut off from outside resources like electricity, water, and food. In Jerusalem, about an hour and a half from Gaza, and still close enough to sometimes take rocket fire, many Israelis are enraged by the conflict, saying despite their government's famed security prowess, it failed to protect them. Others in this market blame the Palestinian people as a whole, saying the two sides of this conflict have never been more at odds. Nir Barashi is an Israeli citizen who is planning to report for military service soon.
I say it again, all us or them. We can stop. We need to eat them and eat them strong.
Hamas, the militant group that launched the surprise attack on Saturday, rules in Gaza. Hundreds of civilians on both sides have been killed and thousands have been injured. Outside the Gaza Strip, debris from the first days of this new war remains on the abandoned streets, as Israel mounts its forces for what may soon be even more of an escalation. VOA News reporting from Jerusalem, Kfar Daniel, and southern Israel.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. Russia failed on Tuesday in its controversial bid to reclaim its seat on the UN Human Rights Council after it was suspended by the General Assembly in April of 2022 following its invasion of Ukraine. Leading economists gathered in Marrakesh on Tuesday for the International Monetary Fund's annual conference. Their message was clear: the world economy is beginning to slump as fissures between East and West widen. IMF chief economist Pierre-Olivier Gorin-Chasse said the global economy is limping, not sprinting. The IMF predicts that global economic growth will slow in 2024 to 2.9% from this year's 3%. And authorities in Malawi have started distributing free corn and money to more than 4 million people facing food shortages, largely because of the impact of Cyclone Freddy, which washed away thousands of acres of crops in March. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin is in Brussels for the Ukraine Defense Contact Group meeting. This as American military planes full of supplies are departing for Israel, and as the Pentagon formally declares the recent change in government in Niger a coup. What does that mean for U.S. policy? I'm joined by VOA's Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb.
So they are planning to show Ukraine that the United States and all of Ukraine's Western allies are still very much committed to supporting Ukraine for as long as this takes. And this is going to be hard to do because as Secretary Austin is heading to Brussels, there is still not any additional funding that has been passed through Congress because Congress is still waiting to get a Speaker of the House so that they can continue to pass bills.
That brings up my next question is, how can our allies take us seriously, when we don't have leadership in place, when the Congress seems to take itself out of the picture?
Well, I think that the Pentagon is hedging on the fact that there is still about $5 billion left that the United States has authorized to give Ukraine, and they are going to be providing some more of that funding at the Ukraine Defense Contact Group. Secretary Austin was speaking to reporters today, and he confirmed that there would be another U.S. aid package that was announced. I had been speaking earlier today to multiple U.S. officials that confirmed to VOA that the U.S. is going to be providing up to $200 million in additional military aid for Ukraine.
And I think any discussion about defense, about foreign aid, about the Pentagon in general, we have to be discussing Israel as well. How do the recent events there figure into the Pentagon's calculations with Ukraine and just sort of what the Pentagon is doing in general?
Well, so the situation in Israel and the situation in Ukraine are not linked. What is important for U.S. officials in this instance is they want the world to know that this is not just your normal Palestinian attack on Israel. Officials are saying that this is Islamic State level savagery. They say that some of these Hamas militants have been murdering kids in front of their parents. Hundreds of Israelis have been killed. They launched thousands of missiles into Israel. So it requires a very strong response. And so officials have said that planes have already taken off from the U.S., surging weapons to get to Israel.
Carla, changing gears completely. Today, the Pentagon declared what happened in Niger about 6 weeks ago officially as a military coup. Can you tell us what that means for Pentagon policy going forward?
So at the moment, there's not much of a change for Pentagon policy in Niger. As officials explained to reporters today, the normal steps that the United States would make if it was going to designate a country a coup, they already started implementing those over the past several weeks. As you know, as we've discussed on this program, the United States has not been conducting any training of their Nigerian counterparts. They've not been conducting any counterterror operations with their Nigerian counterparts. So for now, U.S. forces are going to remain in country. And I asked today to get specifically how many U.S. forces are there. And there are still about 1,000 U.S. forces in country. But the designation of a coup just solidifies that there is not going to be any military-to-military cooperation with Niger. And the reason that the United States wanted to take this action now is because they say that over the past 2 months, they have exhausted all available avenues to preserve constitutional order. They said that the Constitution requires that a democratic leader be in place within 90 to 120 days. And they said that it's become very apparent that these new military leaders have no inkling and no desire to follow the constitutional order. In fact, that they told U.S. officials that they want to repeal the Constitution and create a new one. So that was kind of the breaking point for the United States, and that is why today the U.S. has designated this military takeover a coup.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. Carla, thanks for your reporting. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. China's Belt and Road Initiative has brought much-needed infrastructure to many places in Africa, and it has also brought crushing debt. We'll get that story from Nairobi in a few minutes. Now, we're off to the other side of the continent. Liberians went to the polls on Tuesday to choose their next legislators, senators, and president. Many showed up to exercise their right to vote despite delays and some procedural problems, as Sananu Tord reports from Monrovia.
Thousands of voters queue up at polling stations in Liberia's capital to select a president, senators, and legislators in the country's fourth national election since the end of the civil war in 2003. Campaigning for the election has been marred by political violence, leaving many injured and at least two people dead. However, one observer says the initial processes on election day have been peaceful. Abdoulaye Masayimbi Bangura is the observer group leader for the G7 Plus organization of conflict-affected countries.
Voting started here on time, so we hope it will continue that way. We've been to four stations, as I said, and all of the places we've been has been very peaceful, and the voters have been very orderly.
but there were exceptions. At the Monrovia Open Standard Church School polling center, tempers fled as voters argued with polling officers. The voters said a directive prohibiting the use of mobile phones in polling stations had not been communicated to them. Obed Zonde is a frustrated voter.
Send text message to people will not solve the problem because there are other people, there are other librarians that cannot read. It's not everybody that is educated. So why can you send text message to people? Why can you to a public city that other people who are not educated to learn that just we did that just all bring from there?
At the FMCA school polling station in Monrovia, about 1,000 people stood in long queues for more than 6 hours after voting commenced. Despite the long wait, voters say they are eager to make their voices heard through the ballots.
I want to vote. I'm feeling tired now, but I won't go home. I'm going to vote because Liberia is all we have, and we need to vote and make the right decision.
The Electoral Commission says it will make sure all voters cast their ballots, even if it means keeping polling centers open past closing time. David S. Brown-Lansana is chair of the Electoral Commission.
We will still run the process. They just need to ensure that they are in the queue before the official voting time ends, which is at 6 o'clock, and all of those who are in the queue will get the chance to exercise their franchise.
About 2.5 million Liberians are registered to vote in Tuesday's elections. Liberia's National Elections Commission has urged voters to remain calm after voting and wait for official results to prevent disturbances. Sena Nutod, VOA News, Monrovia, Liberia.
It was revealed Tuesday in his New York fraud trial that former President Donald Trump acknowledged in a document that the size of his Trump Tower penthouse was a lot less than he later claimed. The AP's Julie Walker has that story.
Evidence shown at Donald Trump's New York civil fraud trial shows that he signed a 1994 document giving the true size of his Trump Tower penthouse at just under 11,000 square feet. It was listed later as 30,000 square feet on his financial statements that were given to banks, insurers, and others to make deals and secure loans. The evidence appeared in an email attachment shown during testimony from Alan Weisselberg, the former finance chief of Trump's company. The state attorney general's lawsuit alleges that Weisselberg engineered Trump's financial statements to meet his demands that they show increases in his net worth despite appraisals to the contrary. Trump denies any wrongdoing. Julie Walker, New York.
And finally, today, some 150 countries, many of them in Africa, have signed on to China's 10-year-old Belt and Road Initiative, also known as the BRI. And while the multi-billion-dollar global infrastructure project has helped bring roads, rails, and infrastructure, it has also left some countries saddled with debt. VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Miriama Diallo takes a look at the impact the initiative has had in Africa, including its many benefits and criticisms.
The standard gauge railway, which debuted in Kenya 6 years ago, was hailed by Kenyan officials as one of the biggest and most successful projects since the nation's independence in the 1960s. Travel time from Mombasa to Nairobi used to be up to 10 hours. Now, it only takes about 5 to 6 hours.
You are a businessman, you're going for an interview, it saves your time.
Kenya borrowed some $5 billion from China to build railway lines connecting the port city of Mombasa to Nairobi and Nairobi to Naivasha. This is part of Chinese leader Xi Jinping's Belt and Road Initiative, or the BRI. It's a global infrastructure, trade, and telecommunications project that includes the goal of connecting Kenya to Uganda, Rwanda, and South Sudan. Vincent Kimosop is a Kenyan economist and consultant with Sovereign Insight in Nairobi.
The good side, one is that it's a framework for transportation. Transportation of goods, transportation of cargo.
But Kimosop wishes some things were done differently for the railway, also called SGR.
I wish those who were responsible for negotiating the SGR would have actually looked at the repayment. It's a massive investment project. To have repayments be done in less than 20 or 30 years, that was quite ambitious.
During its construction, critics of the project protested its potential impact on wildlife. A part of this railway cuts through the Nairobi National Park. Over the last decade, some 150 countries have joined the initiative, including most African countries. China expert David Sachs.
Africa's population is growing significantly, and there's a need, you know, on the continent for more infrastructure. From the Chinese perspective, Africa is desirable because it wants to secure inputs for its manufacturing sector. And when it looks around the world, a lot of these, whether it's copper, cobalt, or other minerals, are found in Africa.
Countries such as Kenya, Ethiopia, and Zambia have seen massive Chinese-built infrastructure. But some countries have also been struggling with debt, including Zambia, a major Chinese borrower, which was the first country to default on its debt during the pandemic. The West has been critical of China for lending to poor countries and says it must quickly provide relief to those that ended up with unpayable debts.
Prompt action on debt is in China's interest.
Sachs notes a lot of countries joined BRI at a time when economic growth was quite robust, but that shifted.
The first shock, of course, was the COVID-19 pandemic, which really eviscerated global economic growth, but also hit the developing world particularly hard. And then the second one, I think, of course, was the war in Ukraine. Africa, major importers of food, as well as oil, prices for those commodities have gone up tremendously.
Back at the train station, many of these travelers mostly enjoyed their ride.
It is a safe mode of transport that we as Kenyans, we embrace it.
A recent Boston University study finds that lending to Africa by China has dropped to the lowest level in two decades. Analysts, however, say while the BRI is here to stay, Beijing may be moving toward smaller investments. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There have been inflection points throughout history, noted Secretary of State Antony Blinken at the University of Texas at Austin. We had an inflection point after World War II. We had another one at the end of the Cold War. And we believe we're in one of those right now, he said.
You have a reemerging great power competition that is primarily engaged in shaping what the future looks like. We've hit the end of the post-Cold War era, and now there's a competition on to shape what comes next. And at the same time, we have extraordinary transnational challenges, issues that are affecting people in every corner of our globe, including here in the United States, whether it's food security, whether it's climate, whether it's the way all of these emerging technologies are being used, whether it's mass migration.
And none of us, not even the United States, can effectively deal with these challenges alone, noted Secretary Blinken.
There's a premium on American engagement and American leadership, because in the absence of us doing that, one of two things. Either someone else is going to do it, and probably not in a way that reflects our interests or values, or maybe just as bad, no one does it. And then you have a vacuum that's likely to be filled by bad things before it's filled by good things.
There's also a premium on finding new ways to cooperate with other countries toward a common purpose, said Secretary Blinken.
And here, it's my profound conviction that no country on earth has a greater ability to mobilize others in positive collective action than the United States.
And finally, said Secretary Blinken, we've made historic investments over the last few years to put us in a stronger position not only to do well by people at home, but also to compete effectively in the world. And if you have a strong foundation at home, it does wonders for your standing and your strength around the world. That's what we're seeing play out every single day around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.